I am not the only one who made it in, although I had further to come, I think, than most of you. But it was 3.5 hours to drive here this morning from my house. Most of it was spent in Mississauga on the QEW. I almost fell asleep sitting in the car stationary with the sun pouring in. Okay, so last time we had indicated how Peter Jones's solution is going to go. We're going to construct FK's holomorphic in the upper half plane such that they give you the 1-0 solutions at the points ZJ. And we have a very strong control on their Calamity norms. Of course, they're bounded, but even better when you add them up, they're point-wise bounded for every Z in the disk. Okay, we had, what? So we introduced a function to make things better at infinity, G of Z is minus 4 Z plus I squared. So G has pull at I, and then we just translated it to another, or to a point of the sequence by simply translating by XK, dilating by YK, and we got GK Z was G at Z minus XK over YK. GK has a pole at ZK. And of course, I should have reminded you that, of course, G of I is 1, that's why I say it has a pole there. G of infinity is 0. Okay, and now for the next step, we want to introduce the Poisson kernel. Let's recall that Poisson kernel for R across 0 infinity, the upper half plane, or at least the closed upper half plane, is Y X squared plus Y squared. That can also be written as just Y over Y Z squared. And now it turns out that the modulus of this thing, the modulus of G, is nothing but the, or at least on the real axis, the modulus of G is nothing but the size of this Poisson kernel, one horizontal line above. So the idea is, here's R, and down here is Y equals minus 1. If you look at the Poisson kernel for the orange half space, so Poisson kernel for that is that, and for R cross minus 1 infinity, that's the orange one, of course, you just add 1 to the y, which is the same as z plus I squared, or maybe it's sometimes better to think of it as z minus I bar squared, because the pole is at I, and it's the denominator is z minus the thing bar squared. So then g of z in modulus equals this Poisson kernel. Let's give this one a name. Let's call it U of z. Has a pole at, well, oh, not a regular, not a rigorous pole. My own notation. It's one at I. So I'm thinking of that as the so the function is not one identically, but it's one at I. It vanishes at infinity, comes up a little bit like this, and we want to take that function by its pole and drag it over here. So yeah, pole is not the right word in complex analysis to use here. Maybe just the not top. It's not even the top either. But anyways, this they coincide for z in the boundary. So u is obviously harmonic. So u is positive harmonic, and u is equal to or greater than g in the boundary. That's obvious. First of all, mod g is subharmonic, so you can just put it underneath, or just look at the formulas. I mean, the other one gets bigger as you go away. The difference is like some y times. So, anyways, y is the positive harmonic majorant of mod g in the upper half plane, because it coincides on the boundary. And we also do the same translation. Z minus xk and dilation for this, excuse me, and this one becomes, I'll check it in a minute, z minus make sure I have the right formula. That seems to be right. So in the formula for u, z gets replaced by you subtract xk, and then you have scale by the 1 over k. That scales up here as well and down here. And by the time you multiply through by the yk, that gives you the right thing there for the zk bar. And upstairs, you put one yk here, and the other one distributes over the y over yk plus 1. So that is the right formula. And now we define capital U. I'll say a bit more about this in a minute, but let's just define it and prove something about it first. Capital N is the sum of the UJs. Now, at this point, we don't really have to divide by these, but it's convenient. It makes, because of what comes next, because maybe these things are roughly 1, or like the delta or something, so. But it, for what comes later, this is useful to put in now. And we sum over all the zj's that are less than zn in modulus. So we have one estimate for this function. And the lemma is that un then is equal to or less than some universal constant, depending on the Carlson measure constant. Then we get what? 1 over delta z, ln 1 over delta z. Oh, actually, maybe not the ln just yet. Let me check it. That's if I plug in z equals zn. Otherwise, I get something with a y plus yn over y. Let me just look it up. It's yn plus y over y. Yn plus y. So we have this lemma. And of course, just looking at it ahead of time, this is a nice bound. I mean, bounded in terms of things we like, provided y does not get too much smaller than yn. Right? If y is bigger, this goes away. And if y is smaller than yn, then of course this blows up badly. But at least at the point zn, this is roughly 2, this is exactly 2, and this is a reasonable estimate for un of zn, but it can get worse. At least this estimate gets worse as y goes down to 0. And the proof of this is just easy using the
Carlson measure. And so let's just draw a picture. It'll help. So if this is Z, let's call that Z0 to start with. And then we want to consider Z's which are going up and double each time. So this will be Z1. Yeah, we'll see it in the next line. It's going to be an exponential of minus something, and then you'll see why that's the right thing to put in, but not right yet. I mean, it's hard to explain it without putting all the rest of the formula. But let's at least prove that with this definition, it's bounded. This is a thing that's going to go in the exponential, so that when we have e to the minus this thing, it's going to kill the rest of the un as it goes to the boundary. As the UNs go to the boundary, you see in the, so here I am trying to explain it anyways, in the definition we're eventually going to give for the FK, it will look like the definition we had the other day, but with an exponential, e to the minus, roughly, that thing. And the thing we had the other day, you're summing up a bunch of Fs, or in this case, Us, and if you're close to the points ZK, the U's are roughly 1, right? Because they're 1 at ZK. So that the things you're summing up are bad in the neighborhood of the ZKs. They decay nicely away from the ZKs, but at the ZKs, they're bad. And so what we want is to multiply by e to the minus something, which will kill the size there so that they can add up. Remember, the whole sum of them has to add up. The sum of 1's won't add up. So you have to make sure that when this is large, that term will appear in there, and the e to the minus it will kill it. Let's just wait and see. But that's the idea, is to kill the thing with the exponentials. Well, let's prove this first, because without this we can't make any progress. Separated in the Euclidean norm? Yes. Oh, yeah. But here they can cluster. Yeah. And they've got lots and lots of ones. Yeah, in the Euclidean sense, you couldn't have anything beneath a point like that. Here you can have infinitely many. But the Carlson condition will help control this and ultimately the whole thing. So the idea for this proof is to start with a break in this thing like this. And of course, somewhere along the way, there will be the height yn. It could be anywhere. I'll just draw it at random. So what are we summing up in there, in the uj's? We're summing up all the j's, such that the zj's are in there, not the ones above the red line. Okay, so you write it out. Equal to or less than, well, first of all, it's the sum of the ones in there. What's that going to be? So it's the sum of the zj's in the tent corresponding to z2. This one. Also, of course, the ZJs equal to or less than, the YJs equal to or less than YN. So they stay below the red line. And then what do you sum up? We wrote it somewhere. At the top. There. So the things we're adding up, you're going to get a 4 and a YJ. And now what about the rest of it? Well, here's the Z. All the ZJ bars are, of course, down here. Or the ZK bars, ZJ bars. They're on the lower half plane. So the distance from a Z to any of these is at least equal to or greater than Y.
So on the bottom, you can put a y squared. Also, in this first one, the zj's involved don't exceed some constant like 4 times y. So if I ignore the actual constants and just put a c there, this is maybe at least 16, we get c times, if I factored out the yj, I have 1 y on top and 2 on the bottom. Just a single y. But let me see how I wanted to write that, because I wanted to keep it in the yn plus y over y squared form. Okay, so the so for the first term, we pull out one of the yj's, this one, and then here we have y plus the yj's at most yn, so we put y plus yn, and then divide by y squared. So we didn't do much there. Plus the sum, and now we go from k equals, or maybe I should put, I'll use L. L equals 2 to infinity. And then you sum over what? You sum over the zj's in the difference of 2/10. So the tenth zl minus the previous tenth, and still always yj's equal to or less than yn. And here, what goes inside the sum is pretty much the same thing. It's going to be the yj, and if we take the yj out, what do we do with the rest of it? Again, we have y plus yn over y squared, but this time it's a little bit different. It's y plus yn over, and there's a constant, of course. What goes underneath is the distance between z and the zj bar. So the now we're on an annulus out here, so the zj bars live down there. The distance is at least 2 to the ly, right? Because it's getting big. Yeah, this is a definition. If this is z, z0 is defined to be z. Z1 is you just double its height distance from the boundary. Then you double it again. I didn't actually say that. So I should give you a definition. ZL is x plus I, and then you keep doubling. Y. Sorry. That would have been useful earlier. So down here we have 2 to the ly squared. So that's the extra gain. Okay, so what do we get? We put all this together. Well, we have this constant that comes out front, the yn. Let's do the first one. If you sum up the yj's, now we're going to use the Carlson condition. If you sum up the yj's in this first blue tent, you get some constant times the side length, which is roughly, again, just some multiple of y.
So we sum first in the first
yeah.
Then
we sum in this one. Then we sum in this one. And then you just keep going out. So in that first one, we get a constant yn plus y over y squared. So constant y plus yn over y squared, but you actually perform the sum in the yj's and you get at most some big constant times y. So maybe I'll just put it like that. So it's going to kill the y on the bottom. And that's actually the estimate that we're claiming, because this particular constant depends on the delta by this this 1 over delta times log 1 over delta. No, it doesn't. It just depends on the log 1 over delta. So where do we pick up the additional 1 over delta? I missed it. Back in the beginning, I forgot about this thing. That's a 1 over delta, right? Because those things are by definition bounded below by delta z. That's the definition of delta z. So everywhere in these estimates, I should have a 1 over delta z. And similar to here. Right, so I've got that over delta z. And now here, this one this is the constant you get for the Carlson measure constant. It's just the log part, not the 1 over. Anyways, you're going to get the product in the end. So it's that plus, and then you get the sum L equals 2 to infinity. Well, you can see it's the same thing because here. Because what you're going to get here is this same constant, but instead of times y, at the L stage, say you're in the green one, it's going to be the length of the interval is 2 to the L y. So you're going to get an extra 2 to the L y on top, but we have a 2 to the L y squared on the bottom. The upshot of all that is you get a 1 over 2 to the L y altogether. So the rest of it's going to be C over delta Z on 1 over delta Z. And then you're going to have Y plus YN over just single Y. And then you're summing up 1 over 2 to the L. Because there's a whoops, what did I do here? It's equal to or less than this. I should have done the sum of I was trying to avoid writing it all out twice, but I'm just making mistakes. So you get that times that. There was 2 to the ly squared, and then there's 2 to the ly. Anyways, you add all that up, and you get implies dilemma. Yeah, I won't write it out again. I mean, this sums up to exactly that. Yeah, I just wrote the wrong thing here. Yeah. It's this one. Yeah, thanks. Yes. Distances to the boundary. I mean, the picture was right. So, below the red line is where we're summing. Okay, so that's the proof. Now, we have our function which works, which is going to be fn of z. So we get fn of z. Well, remember we start off with the Blaschke product corresponding to the roots, corresponding to the points in Z. Then, of course, this is the Blaschke product with the nth factor missing, so it no longer vanishes at Zn. You evaluate it there. Obviously, this product is a nice bounded holomorphic function with value 1 at Cn, and it vanishes at all the other things. So it was already a good candidate for Fn. However, the absolute value is big on the boundary. It's 1. So we had to then multiply by the gn, z, to at least make it locally better. And now to make sure that when we add all these up, that we even push down at all the bad points where they cluster, we put the e to the minus, and now there's a parameter here. This is where I'm running out of chalk. So what I'm about to write there, of course, is not un. I want to write something holomorphic. So the idea, this is the simplest thing possible, so this is just a harmonic conjugate of un. Remember, since this is in an exponential, we're only going to care about the real part of it for size anyways, so we don't care about the harmonic. We just want to make it holomorphic. And what we put in here is gn z minus gn zn. It's the 1-0 stuff, right.
And then the second
localizes it pretty close to Zn, but it's still bad far away if the points cluster. But this guy, remember, is precisely, where's the estimate? Lemma. This guy will get big. I mean, close to 1, that's what I mean by, sorry, not close to 1. It'll get big, like yn over y, as y goes down to 0, especially in the neighborhood, well, you can't see it from the estimate, but especially in the neighborhood of the points this will push down. You'll see it in the, at the final line of the proof. So this is the thing to make sure that this guy is even really small at the other points, the other zk's, which are underneath zn. For example, they could be directly underneath. And of course, then they're quite bad, right? If this part of the function, if, well, of course, there's other points that vanish. Sure, if that's a zn, of course, this guy will vanish at all the zk's underneath. That's true. But the gnz itself stays big. It's like 1. And you've got to, so at the other points zk that are underneath that, you want to push it down. And this pushes it down enough. Anyways, let's just, it's only like 1 line away, so let's just finish the line and then we can discuss why it worked. Okay, so where gn is, of course, holomorphic. So now we have, let's just write out one estimate for fn, and then we see instantly, with the correct insight, that it, you get that, the bound. Alpha is a parameter that we will choose at the end. I can tell you what it's going to be right now. Define this for alpha positive to be chosen. It's going to be equal to, I think, 1 over this. But you choose it at the end to minimize something. And I think 1 over that is what works. Something like that. Okay. So let's look at what estimates we have. So we only have 2 steps left. We're going to write down the obvious estimate we get for Fn, and then we're going to sum them up, and that's when we use this this really beautiful idea that the thing we're summing up, although it looks horrible for a fixed z, it's a lower Riemann sum for e to the minus t as integral 1. Just incredible observations. Very pretty. So what's the estimate? Well, the bn's, of course, are at most 1. They just go away. This we want to keep with us because it's also buried in here. We want to keep those together. So we're just going to look at the gn, and the modulus of gn is at most un. So we're going to have here un of z over bn. Remember, un is a positive harmonic function. This is the little un. And then we have e to the minus, and then take real part. So this is the capital un. It's the sum of the little uj. It's the sum of these things for j, for the zj's closer to the boundary than zn. That's what's in un. It's the sum of these things, but uj's with the j's closer. So there's a zn. These are all the zj's that are closer to the boundary than zn. That's what we're putting in here. So you can already see a Riemann sum coming out of this, because this guy will be the delta of this sum. But let's wait till we get there. So there's that, and then, of course, there's the other term, e to the alpha unzn. Well, for the unzn, remember, this was a bad estimate for y small, but it was a good estimate when z is equal to zn, because then this is just a 2. You just get this expression that we expect to be the ultimate bound anyways. So this is equal to or less than some constant, and let me just call it delta of, I'll write it like this, delta z. So this thing I'm going to be defining, this thing, right, it's the quantity that we expect to be, it's the quantity that we proved was the upper bound for the interpolation when we actually proved, when we used Carlson's proof. I mean, this was the thing that we called mz. I mean, mz was bounded by this, but some multiple of this. So, it's not that, it's e to the alpha that. So it's e to the alpha delta z, right? This un at zn is equal to or less than some constant times that. Probably, I want to include that constant. I mean, I haven't kept track of what it is. It's an absolute constant. Because I want to just write this. The which? No. No, because... Do I? So it was the next line where you get to define it. Thank you. So it's at Zn. But we want to call that. Yes, good, thank you. So we get this, that's that term, and of course this one just stays the same. And at this point, let me just... So you arrange... Remember, we can have a finite sequence when we do this. You can arrange the zj's decreasing, and... It's simpler to imagine it and strictly. So in other words, we'll just assume that there are no ties. So we find there's no ties. I mean, obviously, you can, for a finite sequence, you can perturb them infinitely small amounts. It's not going to change much. I mean, the deltas will change by very little, as little as you like. So you can make this assumption. It's easier to picture what's going on, because otherwise you have to say what happens when there's ties, and it's just annoying. So let's assume the zj's go down. So that would be, not the zj's. I keep saying zj's. Yj's. Y1, y2, etc. It's the y's that go down. Distance to the boundary decreases. And let's put tn equal to the alpha unz. Incidentally, this is for a fixed z now. The constant won't depend on the z. So where tn is equal to this, which of course is the alpha times the sum of the yj's equal to or less than yn of ujz bj zj. So if that's tn, then what's this? This is Tn minus Tn plus 1. And what's this? This is E to the Tn. Minus Tn. Thank you. E to the Tn would not get us anywhere, because we're going off to infinity. So this is E to the minus Tn. There's the delta T. Notice that these Tn's, that's 0, infinity, Tn right? The higher you go, the less you sum. So the TNs decrease strictly to zero because of the assumption I made about the YJs being strict. So now you add them up, and what do you get? Remember, we fixed Z here. This is for a fixed Z, so I haven't indicated the dependence of all these things on Z. But what we end up with is N, it's 1 to infinity, FNZ, equal to or less than R. Ah, some of you would be wondering, there's an alpha in the TN, but there was no alpha here. I forgot. This is only that if I multiply and divide by an alpha up here. I forgot to do that. So here you would put, you know, alpha there and a 1 over alpha here. So then you have this factor times, and now I can write it as the difference of two t's, because the difference of the two t's has an alpha in it. Just forgot to put it in. So, I mean, this is the magical part of the proof, is recognizing it as this particular lower Riemann sum. Or e to the minus t. Because you have e to the minus tn times tn minus that one, that's equal to or less than the integral of e to the minus t over this little range. So, we get, let's first... The big set, yeah. My Z with the line through it is the capital Z, meaning the set of all the points. And this Z here, without the bar, is just an arbitrary point in the upper half plane. Just an arbitrary point. It's the point that occurred in the lemma. Right, the point in the lemma is just anywhere. So we get equal to or less than, well, there's this e to the, I could put that in front, e to the alpha, alpha v over alpha, and then the sum n equals 1 to infinity of, and now I can write the delta tn, with the delta going that way, e to the minus tn, and that's equal to or less than the integral from 0 to 1. So that's the part I like, is the fact that it all just reduces to e to the minus t dt. Anyway, so we finish it. This is just another constant. And if you choose alpha equal to 1 over delta z, you get e times delta z. Alpha equal to 1 over delta z. So the upper bound is just whatever this constant was that we didn't keep track of times the thing we expect, the thing that we proved before using duality. Same constant comes out. If you read Seip's monograph on this, he actually goes into some detail about the sharp constant, which I haven't done.
So basically every integral from 0 to 1 or from 0 to
infinity? Oh, infinity, yeah. Yeah, this could be arbitrarily big when you start.
So basically any alpha would
work. Well, you can put any alpha in, yeah, but then you're going to get a terrible estimate. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, so here is where we chose the alpha to approximately minimize this quotient. I don't think it exactly minimizes it. You can do calculus, but it won't be very different. It'll be off by a factor of.
So the constant, of course, depends on the set of one.
Yes, that's the delta z. It's actually this capital delta z is this one in terms of the little delta, and of course the little delta z is that uniform separation with the Blaska products, which is directly dependent on the points in z.
maybe it's also important that the function e to the minus t is monotonically decreasing, because you know that the original sum is bounded from the graph by the integral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. We're using that, this thing is underneath the pink thing, yeah. And of course it has to be integral from 0 to infinity. But I think it's, I just still think it's amazing. If you look at the paper, I don't know, this was in the 1980s, early 80s, I think, that Peter Jones published this. And if you look at the paper, oh, I don't have it with me, but he points out at the end of the proof, actually, he did this proof in a different, slightly different context that we're going to do in a second anyways. But he points out at the end of the proof that he thanks three mathematicians. I must confess, I can't recall the names offhand. I suspect one of them was refereeing the paper. he thanks three mathematicians for pointing out the above proof. That's this one to him with the lower Riemann sum, which replaces, he says, a slightly longer proof of his. So I don't know what Peter Jones's original proof was. I mean, obviously the whole idea is very beautiful anyways, but this last little trick with the Riemann sum was apparently noticed by some other people. Anyways. okay, so that's that. This proof is actually fairly robust. It doesn't look that robust here. Upper bound, yeah.
Where does that fact come in the proof?
Well, because...
You're just using one piece of data somewhere?
No, it comes at the very top. You get a plus sign here because it's UNZ minus UN.
That's fine. UNZ, I'm having a concern about.
Oh, you mean why did I bother to prove this with the general Y?
Yeah.
Oh, to show that UN was a positive harmonic function and not identically infinity somewhere in the upper half plane.
Okay.
I wanted it finite. That's all.
Okay.
Plus, I wanted this. As you're pointing out, this is the only thing we ever use. Except that in order to get a holomorphic function, capital GN, we need to know that this is a positive harmonic function defined at every point in the upper half plane. That's the only reason for this, yeah. Thank you. I forgot to point that out. That's pointed out in Peter Jones and also in Seip. So, yeah, I just forgot to mention that. But yeah, we don't need this other than for qualitative reasons. But we do want the Sharpe estimate there. A bounded harmonic function, but it has to have that control, or it won't help us. So I don't know if there's any other way you can get at that function other than by defining it to be the sums of the ones underneath. But in any event, I didn't want to rush away from this because this is a really nice part of the proof. So. And it's also nice that people have a chance to correct all the omissions I've made and the errors before we go. This is a really beautiful idea. We're going to use this idea right away again to solve the D-bar problem in two ways. The original way that Peter Jones did it in his paper was he basically just did a continuous analog of this trick. And that's where the first proof of this appeared. And then... I'm not sure about this. At the end of the paper, he then pointed out the connection that we're now going to do between solving the D-bar problem, which I'll tell you about in a minute, and interpolating sequences. And for me, that's a really important connection. I really like that. I don't know that it's actually been put to any good use yet in terms of, you know, proving something new that couldn't be proved some other way. But it turns out that solving the D-bar problem can be solved using this particular solution, these FNs. And just to give, for those of you who maybe already know what I'm talking about, just some vague idea, if you're trying to solve a D-bar equation, which we'll explain in a minute, so D-bar U equals some thing, some measure, it's typically going to be a Carlson measure or something related to it. So that's the equation. What you do with the Carlson measure is you approximate it by a sum of point masses, really close together, in the weak star sense. So you can, without loss of generality, pretend your Carlson measure is just a sum of point masses. These sum of point masses, of course, will still satisfy Carlson's condition, the tent condition. Are they an interpolating sequence? Not with good estimates, because it's not separated. So what you have to do is, you know, in each box, there's many, many little points, so you have to extract one from each box to get one Carlson measure with a good separation, and then another, and then you can write the original one as essentially a convex combination of these interpolating sequences, or these measures, delta, attached to interpolating sequences. Then if you use you can solve the interpolation. The interpolation basically means you can assign values at random to the points in your interpolating sequence, and you assign them in such a way that they solve the D-bar problem relatively easily. So it's really kind of a very pretty idea. So let's do that next. We'll just start. I'll state the problem, and then we'll take a 10-minute break. So now we return to the disk. Well, okay. Once again, I have this bipolar personality. We flip back and forth between these as is convenient. I guess if I was careful, I'd rewrite everything to work in the disk, because that's where we really want to work, ultimately. But many of these things are easier to picture in the upper half-plane. So we return to the disk. We want a bounded, C1 intersect C0. So that means we want a solution U. So we want to have a solution that's continuous on D-bar, continuously differentiable inside. We want that solution U to the equation D-bar U equals D-bar U Z equals D mu Z, where, well, what's d mu? Where d mu z is a nice Carlson measure. Incidentally, for this section that I want to describe right now, since we're not actually going to use explicitly any theorem from this yet, because I don't have an application of it, I'm going to be a little sketchy. So I'm not going to give all the hypotheses until the end and etc. So it's just sort of like a bit of a foray through the thing without being rigorous. And then at the end of it, I will go back to the proof that Peter Jones gave for solving this, the rigorous one, and we'll do that. And that's the one we'll use when we go to the Corona theorem. Yeah, that's coming up. Where D bar is this, and D bar is the whatever. I have no idea. It's impossible to remember, and I have it written down, luckily. It's that one. It's whatever makes this the Cauchy-Riemann equations. But you have to compute to find out what it's supposed to be.
So D bar Q equals zero,
means that the function... Analytic, right. So we maybe just note that d bar of u plus iv equals 0 if and only if you carry out the arithmetic. U sub x is v sub y, u sub y minus v sub x, i.e. u plus iv is holomorphic. And of course, I should have, I don't want to go into the explanation now, it'll take too long, but the reason we want to actually be able to solve this equation is that when we go to the Corona theorem, which is the next topic in section 2 or 3, in the Corona theorem we will, as Brett mentioned in his lecture, you can write down obvious solutions to the equation you want, except that they fail to be analytic. It's the only problem. Sort of like the upper bound we would have had over there that would have worked, except it wasn't holomorphic. This, however, was a little bit more delicate. And what you end up getting is that if you compute d bar of your candidate solutions for the Corona problem, you get junk like this. Turns out they're not quite Carlson measures, but they're related. That was, and Tom Wolfe actually found the correct relation, which is that led him to his very simple proof of the Corona theorem. Much simpler than Carlson's original proof. But anyways, for us, for the moment, if this is roughly a Carlson measure, so we'll just assume for the moment it's a Carlson measure. And in other Corona problems, actually, you can assume that. I don't want to say. I just want to leave it.
But if u is the C1, then it means that the mu is a function, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so that's why I say it's a nice Carlson measure, not an arbitrary bad one. This equation, what you have to do is make hypotheses and a conclusion, but I don't want to do that, because there's many theorems about this, and I can't write them all down at once, so I just want to have a vague idea that we're assuming that d mu is nice enough that everything makes sense, and yes, I want a solution in this space, because the function that appears over here is going to be at least continuous, actually better than continuous, it'll be probably in the same space. Okay, so going back to this one more time, so we end up with d bar of our candidate solutions will not be 0. And so what you would like to do is correct them by subtracting off something d bar of u equals this. However, the something has to have a good property. It has to have nice bounds on the boundary of the disk. So we want, not only do we want a C1 solution to this equation, but with good L infinity bound on T. I mean, we don't see that yet, but that will be the case. And this is what makes it hard, because you can write down solutions to this with Green's theorem in a second. But to get a good L infinity bound, and I haven't told you what that is, that's where all the hard work comes in, and that's where the Peter Jones construction comes in, or at least an analog of it for continuous functions. Or, as I said, you can use weak star approximations. Okay, one more thing, and then we'll take a break. So we're eventually going to be looking at trying to solve this equation. And as I say, you can write down a Green's function solution instantly, but to get a good bound on the L-infinity norm is hard. Let hn of z be equal to essentially the function we had before, gn of z e to the minus alpha capital GNZ minus capital GN CN, that thing, Z minus ZN bar, ZN minus ZN bar. Then given some target value, AJ, in L infinity, we can write the solution that Peter Jones came up with, which is, oh yeah, now we're back in the upper half plane. Eventually, I will write out his solution in the disk. I'll just copy it. Somebody, I found it's in one of G. Chow's papers. He used the Cayley transform and rewrote the whole thing. But we're not there yet. But let's just look at the solution f of z, j equals 1 to infinity, aj, fjz. That's right. Once you have these two properties, that the fn is the 0-1 interpolation and the sum of their absolute values is uniformly bounded, then of course this is the interpolate. This is an interpolating function, because if you plug in z equals zk, the only term that doesn't vanish is this one. You get a 1 times ak, and of course it's in h infinity because of that strong bound. And we can write this in the following way. If we take out the Blaschke product in the definition of the f, well, it's sort of buried at the top there. If you take the absolute values off and replace the little un by what it should have been, and the gn, and put the original Blaschke product bz back in there, you can see that it's this sum, j equals 1 to infinity, aj, hjz, over b prime, zj, z minus zj. Now, this takes a little bit of calculation on a piece of paper, but it's not much. I mean, you have to, because I've replaced the bj, zj by the b prime, zj, and you also have to worry about when you factor out the Blaschke product, some things go in and out. But this is exactly what you get. Notice here that the key point of this formula is that we put the z back in the denominator. So this is not holomorphic. I mean, this part is not holomorphic. Remember, if you multiply by b, this will be holomorphic. But without the b there, this is now a non-holomorphic function. But of course, remember, if you're going to use something like this to solve an equation like that, it has to be non-holomorphic, because otherwise you're going to get zero on the right-hand side. But what is this going to give you? There's a very simple calculation. Maybe I'll just do this next time, but I'll tell you what it is right now. If you take b bar of this f, this is holomorphic. So you use the product rule. Nothing happens there. So you're just going to get, not of b, not of f, of course. F has, d bar of f is 0. It's holomorphic. But d bar of f over b, take the b away. This is the candidate that we're interested in. If you take the d bar of that, hj is holomorphic. Apply the product rule, so nothing gets hit with that term. So all you're going to get is the sum, j equals 1 to infinity, aj, and then you're going to get, the hj at zj, because down here, what's d bar of 1 over z? It's pi times the Dirac measure. We'll prove that next time. That's a Green's function, or a Green's formula calculation. So this guy is going to give you a delta zj times a pi. That's what ddz of 1 over a z is. I mean, if you like, ddz bar of 1 over z is exactly delta at the origin. So this translates it. And then we had up here hj at zj, but the hj at zj, or hn at zn, is exactly 1. Right? I mean, incidentally, that's why we had to subtract the gnzn. It was because I wanted to make sure that this guy was 1 when z equals zn. Right? That was the point. So you had to make sure this in here was real part 0. And I guess it's just 0, so that's fine.
The hj should also be here, right?
But it's the delta z function. It's the delta function. So the only time the hj, so it's hjz times delta, but hjz times delta is hjzj times delta, because you evaluate there. And that's 1. Hj of zj was 1. That's what we were going through this for. It's 1. So you just get a 1 over z prime zj. So from the Peter Jones construction, we have a function we can write down with good control on it, such that its d bar is this sum of Dirac measures.
Well, that's already that's a good start. Did I get it right, though? I'm just worried about why I didn't get a yj in there.
You should build a pop, right? Yj.
Let's just take a break and we'll do it after the break. I got some constants wrong. Okay, so I think we will first start off with the following observation. One over Z. Maybe I'll put Z minus W. So if you take D bar, meaning that if I multiply both sides by a continuously differentiable function, say of compact support, then in fact you integrate, this equation is correct. Well, that will be given by the proof. What I just said, you multiply by a C1 function of compact support and integrate, and the equality is correct. That's what it means to be the weak sense. By C1 compact support and integrate. So let's give the proof of this, or at least the equality that we use. I think it's down here somewhere. We're actually going to prove a little bit more. So it will include this as a corollary. So lemma, let's take G Let's take it C1 and bounded. I think this is enough. I didn't actually put it down here. Define f of z be the integral over the disk G zeta over zeta minus z. Here, so d zeta wedge d zeta bar is, work it all out. It's going to be, again, I don't have it written down, but it's probably minus 2i or something like that. I don't know. Yeah, what would that be? There's a minus I, comes out of this one, and then there's an I, and you have to flip it, so it's minus 2i. It's just that in this formalism, Green's formula is simpler to use. Define f of z equals that, then the claim is that df dz bar equals g z and d. Okay, so under our hypotheses, of course, the f exists because 1 over zeta minus z is integrable and g is bounded, so everything exists. And here's the proof. Given psi C infinity compact support in D, Green's theorem gives the following thing.
What's the
Oh.
So those are all notations for the same thing. Well, it's just like in calculus. There's 50 different notations for the derivative.
Yeah, it's all D bar.
They're all notations for the same thing.
So this is 1 over 2 pi I. And then in here, we have the integral zeta minus z equals epsilon minus zeta minus z equals 1 Okay, where does this come from?
Well, first of all, psi is compactly supported in the disk,
so psi is zero. That one's not there. And this one, well, I mean, this is a contour integral around a little circle of
it's a little circle of radius epsilon
around the point z. And if you use e to the I theta to parameterize it, z plus e to the I theta, you get on the bottom e to the I. Or a little epsilon e to the I theta up here, you get I e to the I theta times epsilon. Anyways, you divide by this and let epsilon go to zero, you get that by continuity of psi. So that's nothing. But now you apply Green's theorem. Because after all, here's the circle of radius 1. And we're taking this integral minus that integral. And Green's theorem says that this is equal to, and then you take it's d bar of psi times some constant, 2i or something. Or just use Stokes' theorem, I guess is the way to do it. Okay, so psi of v equals that equals limit epsilon goes to zero of what? 1 over 2 pi I. And then you're supposed to integrate. I'll just draw it like this. So z is at the center. So it's the integral over that thing. And it's d bar of this thing. So
why all this is equal to psi?
Oh, yeah, because as I said, this is zero. The psi has compact support. Oh, if you make it big enough, anyway, it's zero. Because psi is compactly supported near z. So psi is supported in a place like that. So this integral doesn't even appear. It's zero. And this one, as I said, you let zeta equal epsilon. No, it's zeta equals. Use that as your parameterization. So d zeta is epsilon I e to the I theta d theta. But zeta minus z is epsilon e to the I theta. So the quotient is just 1 over...
oh.
Yeah, so the quotient is I on top. And then you get a 2 pi by integrating around, and it cancels. That's just you perform the integration around the little circle. That one.
Oh. Why do I have
So actually, I have it going this way, don't I? I have it going this way. That's unfortunate. Okay, so I seem to get negative of what I wanted. Let's just leave that for a moment. I find that puzzling. Let's just leave that and see what happens with the rest of the proof. Over zeta minus z, d zeta bar, which d zeta. So that I just copied out was supposed to be Green's theorem. And then, so what happens if we perform the integration? The function down here is actually holomorphic because we're staying away from the pole. So all you get is the d bar applied to psi. Zeta minus z, and this guy, we worked it out before, minus 2i. Aha! There's the minus sign.
Is most difficult for this epsilon around z or around z?
It's around z. Everything's around z. And yes, there is a minus sign here. Because a minus sign just popped up here. So that was the solution. So yes, indeed, psi of z is minus that. So what I was puzzled a moment ago, I'm no longer puzzled. This is correct. And now that's correct. And now the minus sign disappears because we get a minus 2i from the differential. Oh. Oh, no. But we have to flip it back again. That's really unfortunate. Okay. This, but there's another minus sign because I have to flip this. So this is very bizarre.
Where's the extra minus?
From flipping this around. Flipping around. This is very, and of course now when you take the limit, of course, this is a continuous function. This is integrable, so we can actually eliminate the limit now. It's just the integral. And, well, let me just write it back in this form. D bar So this is certainly still this, because I've written it back like this. So this minus sign cancels with that minus sign. So we certainly get this formula. No, I took this back into here. I've written it back in the complex form. So I've written it back. But at least this is correct. It's got the correct sign. I mean, if we had a minus, we have a minus sign there. So we have it there. Here, I put this back in here. So I rewrote it back like that. So the two minuses canceled. I have a plus sign. So we at least have that formula.
Do we have the minus? Do we need to have it to stop with? I mean,
yes. Yeah, because we're going around the little circle.
Is it clockwise or counterclockwise?
Okay. If we go around this in this direction, then I guess we don't need it on the first step. But then when I apply... Okay, so it is a plus one on here. It is a plus one, right? So here it's a plus one. So maybe here it's supposed to still be negative. And here it turned out to be plus. At least that's what I'm getting here. It doesn't agree with my notes, so obviously I made a mistake, but let's just continue on and see what we get. There's more minus signs to come because we have to integrate by parts. So let's just wait and see what happens in the end. But we may as well get it right. We're only going to do this calculation once. And we never need to do it again. Just use the formulas. And so now we want the integration by parts formula as well. And if we integrate f psi dz bar, dz wedge dz bar, so it's something like that, plus dz bar. The sum of those two things is supposed to be minus ddz bar of the product of dz bar wedge dz. Aha. And this is minus the boundary of f psi dz, which is zero. Well, certainly the dz wedge dz bar just got flipped here. That's what the minus sign was for. And apart from that, it's the product rule. So that was perfectly fine. And then this was presumably Green's theorem. Green's theorem says that you take this thing and you put ddz bar applied to this, and then dz bar wedge dz. So that looks right. And then, of course, psi vanishes on the boundary of D. It's compactly supported. So that's why we get zero. So this just means, all this says is that we can integrate by parts, putting in a minus sign. So if we put this together with the previous thing, yeah, the Green's theorem. Right, this is an integration by parts formula. The first thing? Because it's going to come up in the next. Because we still haven't proved the theorem. We haven't shown that dz bar f equals g. That's what we're not going to do, put these two together. So we have a representation for a test function in terms of its d bar, which it's this is, where is it? This is just representing psi as, just by applying d bar to it and inverting d bar. Then we have integration by parts. So now we get the following thing. If we look at df d zeta bar z psi of z dz wedge dz bar. So now we're going to try and prove this conclusion in the weak sense. And of course, since everything is nice functions, it then follows that it's in the pointwise sense as well. But we're going to prove it in the weak sense, which means you multiply both sides by a psi of z, integrate, and hope to show that they're equal. Okay, so what did we do first? I guess the notation here is that this could probably be written as a ddz bar. So here we're just using the integration by parts formula, passing the derivative to the other side. And now we use the representation. We use the definition of f, and then we use the representation. So the definition of f says that we put in 1 over 2 pi I integral over d g of zeta, zeta minus z, d zeta wedge, d zeta bar, d psi, d z bar. Okay, so all we did was plug in the definition of f. Of course, now you apply Fubini. And we get minus, and we do the g integration on the outside. So what do we get? Double integral, d psi dz bar, zeta minus z, dz, dz bar. So, what happened here? Nothing, just everything got copied, but the integration got reversed. And now this integral in here, I want to be psi. And it is. It is. If this minus sign is correct here, it is, because what happens is that the kernel got flipped because I changed variables, zeta and z. So I guess in my notes there's a misprint. At this stage I had no minus sign. There's a minus sign there. And then you get rid of that minus sign when you apply that formula here with zeta and psi switched. Okay. Most of the time I won't care too much about exact constants, but for solving an equation, it should get it right once. So this is then, the minus sign goes away, and you get g psi. So that does it, because that shows that except that now I'm out the minus sign that I wanted for the weak sense. So it seems as if we have proved that the integral of f d psi dz bar is the same as this. Now we can apply this integration by parts formula. I started the wrong place. I started over there. I wanted to start here. Then it's correct. Yeah, thank you. For some reason, I thought this is the start of the equality, and I thought this was an equality. This is the problem of being too close to the blackboard, so thank you. Yes, if we start up there, that says exactly what we want. Df dz bar is g. Because you get to test over all C infinity functions, take up approximate identity, and it's pointwise. Okay. And somewhere from here, we get as a corollary that ddz bar of 1 over z delta 0. I guess formally, if you take g to be the delta function, delta 0, then I guess you have to work out what it is. But then capital F if this is the delta function, capital F should be
1 over...
There's a minus sign here, and there's a 2 pi I. There's a minus 2 I from here, and what you get is 1 over pi. So you get that F is equal to 1 over pi times 1 over Z if G is delta 0. I mean, in this formula.
If I put G equal to the delta function, then F of Z becomes this.
And I think then that equation says what we want. Because then df z bar, if f is 1 over pi z, so that's 1 over pi d bar of 1 over z. Yeah, so it's pi times delta 0. Okay.
So we had proved this for, I guess, g's like this, and then you'd have to take an approximate identity to get this.
Okay, so we're going to use that formula a lot, this formula here, that gives you a solution to the equation d bar something equals g, the solution being f. And it also gives us this weak formula. Okay, so let's... Let's call this next section just a sketch. Not section, just a little 20-minute exercise. So sketch of the connection between interpolation d bar equation.
Yep, thank you.
There's a pi in it. Yeah, that one. The sketch of the solution goes like this. Or the connection, I mean, goes like this. So recall that if f of z is the Peter Jones solution, then we wrote this as the Blaschka product times the function hj I wrote out with b primed zj z minus vj. The reason I wanted to write it in this form with the Blaschka product out was so that we could look at u of z, which is f over b, and d bar of u is equal to just the sum. This is in the weak sense, and we went through this last time, and you get, I'll write it out, it's hj zj over b prime zj delta zj with a pi.
So the only term that's not holomorphic in this whole thing is the 1 over z minus zj. When d bar hits that, in the weak sense, you get the delta function times pi. And of course, that means that when you multiply a delta function by another function, it's just the value of the function that you get there. And then I wanted to rewrite this, since I've now used the fact that the 1 over z is there, I want to rewrite this back in terms of the bj zj's. That will involve... That will involve
that'll give us a 2i. And a yj on top. So continuing with this, we're now going to get an extra 2i out. Hj, zj is of course 1. On the bottom, or sorry, on the top, we get a yj and a dj, zj. This is because of that formula. we worked at it a long time ago. Bj. B prime at ZJ was equal to something like BJ ZJ, and then it was ZJ minus ZJ bar. That was the formula. This, of course, is 2I YJ. So I think, if I'm doing this right, the B prime ZJ becomes this on the bottom, and you put a 2i yj on top. So we're still being explicitly correct. Delta, I forgot the delta function. If you like, of z. Hj and zj was 1. So it's disappeared. Oh, from here. We did this calculation a long time ago. If you look at the Blaska product and take its derivative, you get a sum of a whole bunch of partial ones. When you plug in ZJ, they all vanish except that one. It has that underneath it. Okay, so now it's, up until now, I think it's been rigorous in terms of weak solutions. It's still perfectly rigorous. And now, starts the sketch. Suppose G is a positive measure, actually a function. It's like absolutely continuous. In fact, it's a nice function. It's at least continuous and C1 inside. So suppose G is a positive measure mu. So suppose that d mu is a positive measure, that is a Carlson measure of norm 1. So what do I mean by that? Well, I don't mean that the embedding is 1, I just mean the following thing, and that is that... No, I'm going to assume it's a positive measure now. Mu is a positive measure. Yes, you can consider complex measures and take their variation, but let's just make life a little simpler. So i.e. mu of a tent over an interval is equal to less than the measure of the interval. So we're back in U. If we ever left it, I'm not sure. I guess we did. So we have a Carlson measure of norm of this tent condition, norm 1. So now we choose an R epsilon positive and small, and a capital N large. So choose R, epsilon positive small, capital N finite large. And we're going to make mu have compact support to start with by discarding everything that's below the line R, so that's height R, and also discarding everything that's more than distance 1 over R from the origin. So we're simply going to look at the part of dmu in this big thing. And then we divide the upper half plane into hyperbolic squares of diameter epsilon. And what's that? Well, that's... So you have some sort of grid like this. This is this standard grid, and then down here, of course, you make them smaller. And the next level, you do the same thing again. Yep, exactly a dyadic cube Whitney decomposition. So these are the squares. They're roughly diameter epsilon in the hyperbolic metric. But it's exactly these things. So the distance across here is epsilon in the hyperbolic. Anyway, just those things. Except that it's not exactly the picture I drew. This is the picture of squares hyperbolic diameter 1. So you simply, and this gets a little bit messy now, we simply want to divide each of these up into roughly 1 over epsilon things. So you're going to go like this, roughly. It's going to be... So you divide this up. Oops, we're over. So I'll stop here. You divide this one up into 1 over epsilon times 1 over epsilon little squares. You do the same thing for each one of these. 1 over epsilon by 1 over epsilon. Everywhere. So you now have little tiny hyperbolic squares of hyperbolic radius or diameter epsilon, roughly. And then we're going to approximate mu in the red part by simply taking a point mass at the center of the blue thing where the weight of it will be equal to the total mass of mu in the little thing nearby. And then the sum of those point masses is approximately the measure mu, and it's going to be exactly the measure mu if we let R and epsilon go to zero. It'll be in the weak star sense. It'll approach in the weak star sense when integrated against a continuous function. Then next time, these points here, since mu is a Carlson measure, the sum of all those points will still be a Carlson measure, but the sequence of points you get is not separated by a long shot. Not satisfy a separation condition. So we have to arrange for that to happen. And that's the hard part where it gets very sketchy. But anyways, we'll continue with this on Tuesday. We'll finish the sketch of how we can approximate this measure by those particular measures that we just got the right-hand side for. These guys. We know how to find solutions to these ones. And we're going to show that this measure mu is a weak star limit of convex combinations of these measures. And we can solve those, and therefore the corresponding convex combinations of the solutions will give you the solution to the B-bar problem. And because of Peter Jones's clever construction, the solution we get will have a really nice formula for its L infinity bound on the circle. And that's the beauty of it. So that's next time.